Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Terrific. Well, ladies and gentlemen, wheeler, dealer, horse trainer, arm wrestler, bon vivant, songwriter, string puller, manager of the Yardbirds, Bolan, Japan, Wham, and many others, gastronome, strategist, weapons grade gossip with a hair curling story about absolutely everybody, author and brilliant analyst of 300 years of the music industry in his tremendous new book, which he will be signing copies of later. Please welcome the irreplaceable, the inimitable, and genuinely fantastic Simon Napier Bell. Yes! There we go. We were going to have some lovely pictures up on the screen. Actually, Dave can hold them up. That's how clunky we are. There's going to be a big screen with pictures.
This is what we're going to do. This is what we're going to do. We're sorting out a bunch of pictures to use as visual stimulus during the next hour. And we were hoping to have them on that screen. But as you may have noticed by the frantic negotiations taking place in the break, we didn't manage to do that. So what we're going to do is, as we show pictures, I'm going to hand this iPad around the room.
Can you see them?
And I'm going to
go straight out the door and onto the 94 bus. And
I'm going to trust you all to return it, okay? Right, fine. So there is Simon Napier Bell. And I think we can go, first of all, there's Simon's book, okay? Let's start by talking about Simon's book, shall we, Mark?
Indeed, indeed. Well, I thought you were going to show a picture of the girl who recorded that song, am I right?
Well, okay, but Simon could start by explaining what led him to write the book, I suppose. That's a good place to start.
That's a very good question, which I'm going to echo. She's a brilliant sister, but Dave gives me an idea of a question to ask. Whispering in my ear.
It wasn't quite totally decided to begin with. It was after I'd written Black Vinyl, White Powder, which is the history of the British music business from the end of the Second World War to today, I always had this niggledy feeling in my mind that maybe I should have been a bit more daring and gone a bit broader. And also, that was... I wrote this book, which got amazing reviews, and nobody in America was interested because it's totally about the British music business. So I thought, the next book, I'd better make it more American. So eventually I decided I would tackle it right from the beginning. It's a ridiculous thing to tackle. It's a vast thing, and I couldn't really see how you get it in one book. But I've always been inspired by a little book I picked up in a railway station about 40 years ago called History of the World by H.G. Wells, which is 288 pages. And just totally laughable when you see that title. But when you finished it, you really feel you know the history of the world. So I thought, well, it can be done. And
which you had, because your book starts, I mean, it's fantastic. It really starts in about 1720.
1710.
That's right, with the invention of the copyright law.
1710 was the Treaty of St. Anne, which introduced copyright law, which the government did really to protect writers of fiction and serious tomes of, investigation and discovery. And it wasn't tested whether it would apply to music or not until about 1780, when one of the Bach family was ripped off by a publisher and took him to court. And the judge decided that since music could be written, it came under the same law. And really, that started the music business, because there was one thing put into this treaty which is totally meant to protect writers and made sure they would keep and own their copyright, at least for 14 years in the initial stages. But there was a little extra clause which said, providing there was a written agreement signed by both parties, the owner of the copyright, the writer, would be allowed to sell it. And, of course, that was the most disastrous thing they could have put in there, because it meant that anyone who'd written a song and couldn't pay their bar bill or wanted this week's rent, if there was a sort of slightly unscrupulous publisher nearby for two or three or four or five quid, he could buy the song.
So you're talking about sheet music here.
Well, I'm talking about the song. I'm just talking about the song. Yeah. He could then print sheet music and sell it, and it would, all the money would go to the publisher. Nothing goes to the writer. I mean, it was now the publisher's song. And that was the beginning of the music business. There were two things. How to get the writer to sign you his song, and that was usually quite easy because the writers were usually broke and the publishers walked around with a tempting £5 to give to them. And the other thing, which is the conundrum, which is the music business has lived with ever since and is still the basis of the music business, is how do you make it popular? And from the first day to the last until today, there is one way only: you spend money. It's usually called payola, but it's sometimes called something nicer. But right back at the beginning, and initially at this stage in the 1700s, 18th century, the popular songs were Victorian ballads, Come Into the Garden, Maud, and things like that. The money from them was fantastic. Sheet music for Come Into the Garden, Maud sold for 3 shillings.
People went home and played them on the piano, didn't they?
60% of all middle class families had a piano. And the sheet music for Come Into the Garden, Maud sold initially in 1814 or something for 3 shillings. Now, I know that's only 15 pence, but it's the equivalent today of something like £60 for a piece of sheet music. Yeah. And the publishers took the whole lot because they just bought the thing out from the writer. But what they did is they paid famous singers of the day to introduce new songs. So when this famous singer had a concert, that you put in one new song or two new songs, and they'd get a bribe from the publisher for doing that. And eventually they got royalties too. So the singers got the royalties, but the writers didn't.
There's an absolutely fantastic bit, and I can't remember what the date was now, when the boomers were invented. This is interesting.
When this got to America,
it's fascinating.
And there, the real thing in America was vaudeville. Is this like working still? Just went off.
Hello. No, I think we're there.
Okay. And the thing in America was vaudeville. Exactly the same process took place. You paid a vaudeville singer to pop a new song into his concert. But they had pluggers there, and the pluggers in America just went out and sang in the street. That you'd pay a plugger and he'd sing in the rush hour in Times Square, or he'd go on the station and sing it on the platform.
He would sing your song, in the hope that people passing by would think, that sounds brilliant, I'll buy the sheet music.
Or they'd go into department stores and sit at pianos and play and sing until they got thrown out. Anything to sing the song. And one of the next things they decided, they got boomers. And boomers were, you could get 3 or 4 people who'd go into a vaudeville show where the vaudeville singer had been paid to sing the song, and then when he sang the song, these boomers would all join in, so that the audience felt, "Oh, we ought to know the song."
It's such a brilliant idea, isn't it? This must be a hit. I mean, everyone seems to be picking up immediately.
When he got to the last chorus, one of the things out to is the singer on stage would suddenly forget the lyric. Like the stutter, and one of the boomers would stand up and sing the lyric, and everyone would applaud.
Brilliant! It's caught on already. Exactly.
Wonderful tricks. Yeah.
So the first of these. Bunch of pictures that I'm actually going to pass round the room is this rather splendid lady here. So, who
Lottie Collins.
Yeah. Lottie Collins. Please pass it along.
Yeah.
She's
random.
Lottie Collins is this.
You only need a quick look to get the idea of Lottie
Collins. Don't read his emails.
The source of the book's title. Lottie Collins was a music hall singer. She went to America one day, and while she was there, somebody gave her a rather nice song. She thought it'd be really good to perform, so she came back to England, and it was Tarara Boomdie, and she wrote new lyrics to it and performed it. She performed the verse like a virgin and the chorus like a whore.
So what year are we talking about here?
1888 or 1890. Right, okay. And in due course, a writ came from the American publisher. Oh, and where'd she put the new lyrics if she had it published in England with a picture of herself on the sheet music in her whore pose? And in due course, she got a letter from the publisher saying that he was the publisher in America. And there was a court case. Now, America's never accepted British copyright law, not till the turn of the century. And so they would just take songs, music hall songs from England, get some new lyrics written and just put them out as totally new songs. And didn't usually go the other way around. It's usually Americans ripping off the British songs. But in this case, the writ came from the Americans to the British one. Lottie Collins hired some rather good lawyers who found this was a very old song, which would be way out of copyright, way beyond the 14 years people had known a song, which dated back to the middle of the 19th century, and was a very bawdy, black, southern song.
Oh, really?
Which was sung in the most disreputable places, where a little sex was around, And the lyrics were worse than any lyrics you've ever heard of Tarara Boomdie. And so they went to court, and it was packed. The court was, because Lottie Collins was a huge star, and the song was hugely popular. The court was packed upstairs and downstairs, and at some inadvisable moment, the judge said, "Well, could you read me the lyrics of this song?
Can we hear the lyrics of the original song, the one the
American publisher was claiming was his?" And of course, they were the filthiest lyrics anybody ever heard. And this is Victorian England. It was extraordinary.
Do you remember what they were?
And no, I don't.
They're repeatable.
But I'm sure they're not repeatable even today.
Even today.
And so the barrister for the silk
for Lottie Collins stood up and recited in a very clear, clean British voice, and everybody was totally
fell about.
But then when he got to the chorus and said Tarara Bumdio, the entire gallery stood up and joined in the song.
In the court?
Yes, the court, the Times...
All swaying from one side to the other.
Exactly, and in the Times it reported the chorus was sung five times through before the judge got control of the chorus. And he declared the song of the public domain, do what you want with it.
Yeah. What a fantastic...
That's absolutely wonderful.
That's fantastic. Has that gone round the room?
The next
has anybody pinched it
there?
Yet? Where I is think, it? It's over there. Yeah, it's making its way back. You got the idea. Lottie Collins. Come on.
My feeling was this song and this court case and this bawdiness and this disreputability of stealing. I thought that summed up the whole music business. That's
perfect.
Why I call it the
music. It's a brilliant title.
It is the music business.
But there's a brilliant section that really fascinated me because you made that extraordinary connection with the idea of the template for modern celebrity. But there's a character called Eva Tangway. She's the next picture, actually. So if nobody's nicked the iPad, pass it back to David, he'll turn it on. But she was an outrageous showgirl from about 1910.
She was the template.
Tell us a bit about her.
Modern rock stars. I mean, if you read her story and what she did, and what she, you immediately think of Madonna or Lady Gaga. I mean, yeah. they really sound the same. She didn't sing very well. And this is 1905.
Is that Madonna another echo?
Yeah. that part of the template isn't necessary.
No,
really.
It's not remotely.
As she shrieked and she screamed and she poured champagne over her head on stage, she wore the skimpiest dresses. She had one dress, although she was a big lady, actually, she's not small at all, and she had one dress which was so skimpy, when she pulled it off, she could actually screw it up and hold it in
her
hand.
It was a wisp.
And she had another dress made of 1 cent coins. And she was very, very... She understood getting press better than anybody else. And anything which happened to her, she had jewellery was stolen, or anything happened, she'd get it in the papers. And she made her notoriety that way. And there was a famous case once where someone ran in front of her as she was striding from the stage to her dressing room, and she grabbed a hatpin from her head and stuck it in the person's chest. Which was pretty nasty and very assaulting, and they called the police.
Pretty poor show.
And when the police came, she pulled $10,000 out of her purse and threw it in their face and said, "This is for you, I'm going for my dinner."
Yeah, but made sure she got it in the papers, didn't she?
Oh, it was all
absolutely
in the papers.
Brilliant.
The journalist was there waiting for her to do it.
So do we get the impression from stories like that that the early days of the musical, which we all like to think of as very cosy and antiquated, were actually far more racy and provocative?
Incredibly racy. And
well,
even
Eva
more
Tango
racy.
Had a song called "Go As Far As You Like," didn't she?
Yeah, she said that was one of her songs. And then even more racy than that was the Southern Circuit for the black musicians, because in the South there was a circuit just for
the Chitlin Circuit.
I'm trying to think now. I've forgotten the name of it, but it was literally for poor blacks in the South. It was 25 cents to go in. You saw a 3-hour show, and there was. Well, there was no control over it at all, and it was a lot more bawdy than the Northern musical, that's for sure.
So the next picture, which we're going to look at, but it's going to take a while to get the iPad back here, you're going to have to imagine. I can remember what the next picture is.
There are people tweeting as you, Dave, on your machine. Tweeting about you.
I hope there won't be an Ian Botham incident or anything. I think the next picture is Irving Berlin, who's a kind of key figure in your account.
No, yeah, Irving Berlin. Well, I have to jump back and fill the story in. But at the end of the 19th century, there'd been huge boost in immigration coming from Europe. And amongst the immigrants, an enormous number of Jewish immigrants, most of whom were middle-class German or mid-European, well-educated, many of them musical. And when they got to America, they were not going to get middle jobs. I mean, there were no jobs vacant at all. The only industry with any jobs vacant was the entertainment business, because it was a totally new business. Most of them got jobs as salesmen, selling buttons or corsets or socks or whatever they could. And the ones who were musical started writing songs on an amateur basis. And one by one, new songs, hit songs popped up, written by these immigrant German Jews who had a tremendous understanding of what popular music should be. It should be like buttons and corsets and toothpaste, you know, not something grand or artistic. It's what the public needed, and you change it according to what they wanted. And each one, as they got a hit, immediately became a publisher, because they when they got their hit, they found they didn't get any money. And so the next song round, they weren't going to lose again. So they nearly all became publishers. And in the 15 years from 1890 to 1905, every one of the old New York publishers, very staid, British-descended, you know, called Jones and Brown, they all disappeared, and all the new publishers came along, and there were all these Jewish immigrants. And it completely, totally changed and boosted and energized the American music business. They had a knack for seeing music in this very commercial, but they all loved music,
and
too.
And he had a knack for thinking of the impact and the value of a song.
Well, this was going to
write an amazing song.
The point about Irving Berlin is he was not from this group. He was a Russian Jew, incredibly poor. The family were absolutely had no money in Russia and suffered the pogroms, had their house burnt, were thrown out. So he arrived with nothing. And when he was 9, his father died, and he decided he'd leave home because he just wanted to give his mother one less mouth to feed. And he lived on the street selling newspapers, stealing money, and sometimes waiting in restaurants. And by the time he was 12, he was a waiter, full-time job in a restaurant, a full-time job, but terrible pay. He lived in a... They had hovels downtown where people lived in... They had little tunnel, little what do you call... like tubes. People slept and they paid 10 cents a night to sleep in
right,
a tube.
Yeah, right, yeah.
You know, and you could wash once a week if you'd made it, got a few tips. I mean, it was pretty dreadful. And his ambition was to write music, and he became a singing waiter first. And he sang in the restaurant, and then eventually he wrote a couple of songs. And finally he wrote a song which did quite well. It's a long story about that song, but what happened is he got a publishing deal. Not very good, but he got a publishing deal.
But wasn't the title... Is it the one I'm thinking about? My Wife Has Gone to the
Well,
Country?
That was the first hit he got. The first song he got was a tiny hit, but it was enough to get him a publishing deal. And in fact, I'll tell you about the first hit. He'd written the lyrics to this song, and it was about... there was an Italian in the 1904 Olympic marathon who, when he entered the stadium, he was head of the race, and he tottered and fell because he was faint. People in the stands rushed forward and helped him, and so he was disqualified. And Irving Berlin's song was about an Italian barber who put all his money on this man winning, and they were all cheering in the barbershop, thinking he'd won, and then he was disqualified. And he'd written a song about this. Very funny song, very good lyrics. And he went off to a publisher and said, look at these lyrics. And the chap said, yes, these aren't bad at all. Can you play me the song? Well, Irving hadn't written a tune yet. In fact, he'd never written a tune in his life. But it was $25, and he couldn't afford not to get $25. And so when the man said, is there a tune? He said, oh, yes, of course the tune's written. And the man said, well, would you come in the next room and we'll play it to us, you know? And he couldn't play the piano either. So so he went to the next room, and he sang this song, which he'd never sung. He'd only seen his words. He just instantly composed a tune there and sang the song, and the arranger and the publishing company wrote it all down. And he got his $25, and it was a little hit, a very little hit. And he got a publishing deal. Right, now you can make another one, we'll pay you some more money. And then he wrote this song. He had this idea one night to write a song called My Wife's Gone to the Country. And he did it with a friend. They met in a barber shop, and they all thought, this is a fantastic first line, My Wife's Gone to the Country. And they sat all night thinking of clever words. My wife's country, she's left the kids behind, or my wife's gone to the country, she took the kids. My life, I'm all alone. And he couldn't. It was all too many words. And then suddenly it came to him. In the middle of the night, he woke up. So that's it. Hooray. My wife's gone to the country. Hooray. She took the children with her. Hooray.
It's just your brain. You totally understand the point of the song, don't
and
you?
It was, oh, yeah. And it was a number one song across America. And Irving Berlin became instantly...
Morris has been using this technique ever since. Yes, right.
But he became a top writer instantly.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then the next thing he wrote, which was an extraordinary thing, this is a really important song, was Alexander's Ragtime Band. For a long time, he'd been listening to black music and wanted to work some element of it into songs. He felt there was a way these... You know, the traditional British, English language American pop song could be blended with something much more forceful and black culturally. And he wrote Alexander's Ragtime Band. The thing about Alexander's Ragtime Band is it's not ragtime. Until Alexander's Ragtime Band, every single dance tune always ever going back as far as beginning of European culture was written for military bands who played quadrilles and things like this, foxtrots, and the emphasis on the beat was always on the first and third beats. One, two, three, four, one, and all the dancing was done in that very forceful way. Yeah. If you think back to movies and things you've seen of old dancing, there's always that step forward on the one and the three. And ragtime, which was mainly black music, was also played in that tempo. Ragtime was played da 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 da. Yeah. But Berlin did something on this song which had never been done before. He put the emphasis on the second and the fourth beat, which was the rhythm of African music. And the only place you could hear that was in New Orleans, because New Orleans was the only city which allowed slaves to have a musical party at the weekend. They gave over the Conger Square to the slaves. Every other city wouldn't allow slaves to congregate, but New Orleans allowed it, and so this music could be heard there. And Berlin had been there and heard this music. Yeah. So he did the song with this beat, and it was the first song ever written with that beat, and it became instantly and forever after the beat of popular music.
Absolutely. Going back to your first story about Irving Berlin writing that song to order, you know, in your experience of looking after artists, you know, the theory, some people say you don't need inspiration, you need a deadline. You need somebody with a gun.
Like your articles.
Whatever. Do you find that that's true?
Absolutely.
If somebody says you've got to do it tomorrow, you do it.
There's so many songs. There's a great story in Jersey Boys about that too. They wrote a song in a taxi, their first big hit. It's incredibly common. Absolutely the right way. If you have no deadline, you mull over it. You know, there's a song called Sunny by
Bobby Hebb.
Bobby. Yeah, he took 3 years to write it. It's got four chords and 18 words, and it took him 3 years. Didn't have a deadline, did he?
Yeah.
I mean, it did do quite well, but he could have got the money a bit earlier, couldn't he?
And the other thing, it took 5 years to write Hallelujah, didn't he?
You're talking about the changes in dancing. That's something you touch on later in the book. Sorry, it's just jumping about a second. You talk about that disco music was designed for white people to dance to.
Well, disco, I mean, the basic is we disco. Most of what we know as disco is four to the floor, solid beat. In the mid-70s, the most popular dance music in the world to listen to and to dance to, if you could dance it, was Gamble and Huff and Gamble. And it was a very intricate black American music. It was fantastic, beautifully rhythmic, but it was slightly complex. I mean, if you watch people who can really dance, they can just stand without moving their feet and their whole body sort of goes with it.
So it's soul train dancing,
yeah,
isn't
but,
it?
But, you know, Europeans couldn't do that, and especially, you know, British could almost do it, but you get to Germany and nobody could do it, you know. And in fact, it came from a chap called Peter Meisel, who ran Hansa Records in Germany. He was at a wedding in Bavaria one day, and he noticed how always people who were completely incapable of dancing in a disco when records came on were dancing quite well at the wedding, which had a boom, boom, an umpa band with a boom, boom, boom. So he got back to the office and he thought, if I took all these songs I've got and put a boom, 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 everybody know where, you know, you move your feet on the boom, boom, boom. And he talked to his resident producer at the time, who was Giorgio Moroder, who then made two or three records like that. And that literally started the four to the floor thing, which still goes on today. And so disco was really created to help people who couldn't dance.
Right, right.
Can I just get because we wanted to talk to you about the, you know, the Yardbirds and Bowl and all your management stuff. But can you explain, when I last saw you, you had this wonderful theory about Larry Parnes. And Larry Parnes and the new generation of managers meeting the post...
I think my theories are beyond the theories. They're real facts.
They're facts. They're not theories. That's terrible. It's a fact.
Larry Parnes...
Explain Larry Parnes, yeah.
Larry Parnes was gay, and he was a middle class, he was Jewish middle class, gay, and rather, you know, introverted. He had a shop in Essex selling women's fashion, and he was, he became a pop manager. Long story, that's not really the point. He became a manager first of Cliff Richards, which is quite brief, and then he moved on to several other people. Tommy Steele and a whole range. But bit by bit, he gathered a group of singers, which is his stable of singers, and they all had hits. And he gave them names, Marty Wilde. He gave them very tough second names, Marty Wilde, Tommy Steele. That's his whole idea of doing it. But the fact is they were supposedly rock and roll singers. I mean, they were actually just pop singers who had a little more edge than some of the other pop singers around. But he became very successful. And at that time, homosexuality was illegal and totally illegal. There wasn't any chance at that time that it was going to be legalized. And if you were gay and in your early 20s or just leaving school and you were looking around for something to do, and you actually wanted to be able to live your life openly, there really was nowhere. I mean, you could become a hairdresser, or you might go in the theatre, or possibly the civil service, which had a lot of kids. But you weren't going to live openly anywhere else. And so when Larry Parnes had his success with all his pop groups, although he wasn't known to be gay amongst the general public, you know, gays all knew he was gay, and they all looked at it and thought that there might be somewhere else we could work. I mean, obviously, in the music business, he's not having any problems being gay. So a lot of young entrepreneurial gay men thought this would be a very good thing to do and worth looking. At exactly that time, National Service stopped. Now, there had never been an English beat group. They were called beat groups then, not rock groups. There had never been an English beat group under the age of 23. The Shadows, you have to remember, when they were successful, were all well into their 20s.
Because they'd all been in the army.
Because as soon as a group got together, say, they'd leave school, right, let's form a group, 18, and about 3 weeks later, one of them or all of them would get their papers to join the army. Taken into the army, 2 years later, they were dumped out as adults, and they didn't have all that teenage excitement anymore.
Yeah.
And there'd never been a beat group. But when National Service stopped, all these kids who left school and thought they'd like to form a beat or a rock or soul or rhythm and blues group, copying American groups, could now stay together. And after a year or two of staying together, they got quite good and they wanted a manager. And at that very moment, a huge influx of young gay entrepreneurial men were looking for groups to manage.
It's very fascinating.
And the end result was the first 5 years of the 60s, virtually every single group was managed by...
So that'd be Kit Lambert with The Who... Brian Epstein with the Beatles.
Brian Epstein with the Beatles, with me with the Yardbirds.
You with the Yardbirds. Andrew Oldham.
Andrew Oldham with the Stones, who prefers not to admit he was now.
We can edit this bit out.
Yeah, he won't mind at all. He'd be absolutely thrilled you were talking about
people it. People change. Andrew did change, but he was pretty bisexual that time. And the point was, this was a huge part of what created rock music, because there was no rock music. This was rock and roll, and rock and roll really was part of the old Tin Pan Alley thing. I mean, you called it rock and roll, but the same people wrote the rock and roll songs as were writing the dreadful schmaltzy love songs for, you know, for the big band singers. It was all the songs all came from Tin Pan Alley, and the artists or groups or singers didn't write them themselves.
But also the managers had a really good idea of fashion.
Well, the point about these gay managers is it was against the law. So if you're living your life against the law, an absurd, stupid law, you're going to think other things are absurd and stupid. I mean, there were less interested in following the drug laws. They were less interested in a whole lot of things. And they were very provocative to the groups. I mean, it was the whole thing about smashing up hotel rooms. And this didn't come from the groups, you know. I mean, it came totally from the manager, a good bit of publicity. I mean, when Kit Lambert first said to Keith Moon, you ought to smash your hotel room up. And, you know, this was... They hadn't been in hotels. This
Keith,
young,
I was going to hoping for an early
no,
night.
Keith said, no, yeah, I mean, you know, Keith said, no, it's rather nice, my room.
Yes, I like it as it is.
And,
just got
and
it
finally,
like
after
it.
Yeah. a lot of frustration, he turned a chair over and Kit came in and sort of smashed it. You know, the managers were very outrageous, and they pushed this outrage into the groups. It really came from being, if you like, outside of the main circle
of course,
of the law.
Yeah.
Just talk about Brian Epstein for a moment. It was going to be one of my pictures, but everybody knows what Brian Epstein looks like, you know. So, with your experience of managing groups, I was getting the impression with Brian Epstein, he kind of fell in love with the group. He was devoted to them.
He was
to an extent
incredibly
that almost broke his
Larry
heart.
Parnes.
Second?
Unbelievably similar to Larry Parnes. Jewish, middle-class, provincial, and he had a store. I mean, it was almost a duplicate Larry Parnes. And Larry Parnes, believe me, fell in love with all his young, you know, this little stable of rock singers. I think he was more overtly in love with them than Brian Epstein. But, you know, Brian Epstein was a lonely person and suddenly had this little group of people who he was part of. You know, he was in a club. He had friends. And he was certainly obsessed with them, but I'm not sexually obsessed. You know,
no, no.
These were his friends. And that's why he went on and on and on and on and got them a deal. And, you know, you can look at a manager in many lights. Was he a good manager once they had to do? Was he really good at business and making the most of the money they earned? Probably not. But there's a lot of aspects to a manager, and the one key thing is, can you break your act? Because if you can't, there won't be any money. And he did, and that allows him to be considered a great manager.
But it was Epstein, wasn't it, who told the Beatles that when they went on stage in whatever it was, 62, they should wear matching uniform suits and ties.
Of course, I mean, they
were
all
eat,
they'd
drink,
all been to Hamburg,
or eat on stage. Isn't that brilliant? They used to come on stage with meat pies in Hamburg.
They'd all been in Hamburg.
Smoking, swearing, speaking.
What he wanted is to make them look nice enough to take home and introduce to his aunt, you know, who'd have afternoon tea. And that meant they had to take off these leather jackets and mess and jeans and look all nice and black.
Which is the genius of Andrew Oldham with the Stones.
Who did the other thing, who went the other way. But, you know, Brian's thing was you would say thank you after every song and you were nice to the audience. And so this was quite new and everyone loved it, but they got bored with it and the Stones came along. And Andrew said, no, you say fuck you to everybody and don't talk to them and wear tacky clothes and piss on the wall outside. He just reversed the whole thing.
So what was your first experience of management, and what kind of manager were you?
My first. I mean, I was admiring these people. I wanted to be in. I was in the film industry. I was an assistant film editor, pushing my way up through the lower echelons of A-list society, because I was lucky enough to work on a film with Burt Bacharach, and I edited. This is on Watch the Pussycat, and he didn't know how to write a film score, although he was this hugely successful songwriter. And when I gave him it was my job to measure up the 50 places in the film where a piece of music came and deliver it to him. And he wrote 50 songs, and it wasn't a film score. And the producer and the director of the film were just desperate because they only had 6 weeks to the film being premiered. And they had a contract with Burt. They said they had to use his music. And he went back to America, and they said to me, what do we do? And I said, well, it's easy. You throw away 48 songs and use two and make a score, because a score has to have a flow and, it has to keep resonating back to the main theme. So I had an incredible time. I spent 4 weeks, the happiest weeks of my life, creating a score out of Burt's fantastic music. And it made me a lot of money. I mean, a huge amount of money, because in the film industry, after you've worked 8 hours, you go into double time and a half, and after the 8 hours, you go to double time, and after that, every 8 hours is double the previous 8 hours. And I stayed in the cutting room.
Why did you leave?
I stayed in the cutting room. I finished the bloody film. I stayed in the cutting room for 4 weeks.
Why would you go from that to managing the Yardbirds? This is crazy.
I don't know. Well, this is the next bit of the story. And yeah, I bought a very nice car, Ford Thunderbird convertible, and. And by this stage, with this money, I was...
What year were we talking about?
It's 65.
Right.
And it cost... And I could tell you, a fourth-hand vocal convertible cost more than a new Rolls-Royce. And it was about the stupidest buy you could ever make. A second-hand
van. Not a Honda Civic.
But it was pretty good. I mean, the trunk, the boot went up, and then the thing came back and went in the boot. It was very flash. And you just had to stop in the street and do that, and you could pull anybody, you know. But I used to go to the Ad Lib Club, which was the disco where everybody went. It would be full of film stars and Peter O'Toole and the Beatles and anybody who was happening at all. And all my friends were in the music industry. When I went home at 3, because I had to get up and go to the film studio and edit films, they were all stayed on. And I said, well, how come you don't have to go? I mean, what do you do? And they all said, we're in the music business. So I thought, well, this is the sort of business I want to be in, where I don't have to go home. So when I bought this Thunderbird, I drove up to the Ad Lib Club one night, and unbeknown to me, that an aspiring young group saw this car and saw me arrive, and presumed I must be a rock manager, because who else would have such a gauche, extravagant piece of rubbish? And and then a couple of hours later, when I was sitting in a corner with a large cocktail and nodding away, I can remember it was Gloria by then. I was nodding away, and they came over to me and asked, will I manage them? And I just couldn't hear what they said. It's so loud. And so they all turned up the next day and said, my office, and said, I thought you were going to manage us. And I thought, this is a rather good idea.
So that's the Yardbirds?
No. That was a group called Room 10, and it was three boys who were in dressing room number 10 at the Prince of Wales Theatre in a show called... I can't remember. But anyway, it wasn't much of a show. John Barry wrote the music, and it was a flop. But they did. They wanted to record one of the songs in the show, and I did it with them. And it was useless. I mean, it got nowhere, but I was now a manager. And
who was your next client?
A duo. Diane Ferez and Nicky Scott. Diane Ferez was a young, very beautiful, petite black girl from the West Indies, and Nicky was a young, blonde, very good-looking guy. I think he was a rent boy, actually. But
didn't inquire.
Well, I sort of knew, because they were sort of impinging
different
on my life. I'd met Nicky one night and in a moment of great sort of pleasure. I said, you must do something with your life. I'm a pop manager now, because I'd had this from, maybe I could help you. And so he kept turning up at the office and saying I'd promised him something. And then... in one of my more bisexual moments, I'd done much the same with Diane. She kept turning up the office, and I thought, bloody hell, I'll put them both together and solve two problems, killed two birds with one stone. And so I went and made a record with them. And I didn't know anything about pop music or writing a record. I stole Get Off My Cloud from the Stones and rearranged it with lots of brass and wrote some silly lyrics about I love you and you love me.
And nobody noticed?
It went to number five. That's good. Charts. And so then the Yardbirds called me up and said, you seem to know what you're doing. Would you manage us? So I said, yes, please.
So who and was wasn't the problem with the Yardbirds? Was it Jeff Beck and Jimmy Beck? Later on,
I brought Jimmy in. Jeff was in the group.
But they were both playing the same parts, weren't they?
Yeah, well, what happened is... Yeah. When I took them on, I really knew nothing. I mean, the Yardbirds had been a top... They were a number three group. There was the Stones, the Beatles and the Yardbirds were the three top groups to all. And I knew nothing about the music business, really. And musically, I didn't even know about pop and rock. I liked jazz, and I'd been addicted to jazz since I was about 11. So suddenly I had this group to manage. It's not that I'm not quite clever and sharp talking, but I didn't know. But in a way, sometimes not knowing is good. So I went off to EMI and told them the group were out of contract. They'd signed to EMI through their previous manager. So I said, well, you know, when they left that manager, the contract's invalid. They didn't even check. I think they were so concerned and I was so definite that they just thought, well, better to sign them again than argue. And I asked for more money than had ever been paid, and I asked for a higher percentage than had ever been paid. But it wasn't because I thought I was being clever, because I didn't know. I just thought, it sounds like a good amount of money. If I'd known about the music business, I'd have known you couldn't ask for that much. So sometimes not knowing is quite good, and I got it. I mean, they got 25,000 advance, which is the biggest advance ever.
Huge amount.
By five times. And they got the highest royalty, they got 14% royalty, and they owned the tapes. They weren't owned by EMI, which has never been done. The Stones hadn't got it, the Beatles hadn't got it. But that's only because I didn't know what I was doing. So that was good.
And then, lots of internal friction.
Huge friction.
Yeah.
And of course, because I didn't know.
What
I didn't know is the one thing with a rock group, which you have to do, is keep them together. So if you ask me what the manager's most important job with any group, keep them together. Even if they're a new group, keep them together long enough and they'll start making some music and get noticed. And don't let them break up. But I didn't know that. And Paul Samuelsmith, the bass player, we were in Paris doing a gig, and he said, I hate live work, it's the horriblest thing, I'm utterly miserable. And I said, oh, you poor chap, if you're miserable, you shouldn't do it, how awful for you. Maybe you should leave the group and we'll get somebody else. Idiot, I was. And then they all discussed who they should get, and Jeff Beck wanted Jimmy Page to come in. I knew Jimmy Page well, because as a songwriter, I used him a lot doing sessions, and I wrote songs. He was a session guitarist. And I just knew that if he came in, that Jeff would eventually leave. I just said that will be the end result. And Jeff didn't believe it. He said, no, he's great, and we'll get on wonderfully well. So he came in. He came in, and I had the idea of putting him on opposite sides of the stage. I mean, you have to remember, no sound desks in those days. What you heard when you went to a gig came off the stage. You had amps, and you had to... Before the gig, you had to go and balance it by standing the horse. No, push that amp up, turn them up and put another one over there. And so by doing that, they were playing in stereo, something which no other group could have a guitar in stereo. And it was phenomenal. And we did a tour with the Stones. We did the first hour and the Stones the second hour. We opened at the Albert Hall. And it was unbelievable to hear these two guitars in stereo playing Jeff's solos. But it was unhappy from the first day because Jeff was now having to share the applause on his solos. And Jimmy was playing somebody else's part.
Yeah. This is a marriage
from that moment
made
on,
in hell.
So have you found your experience that kind of jealousy, professional jealousy, is the besetting sin of musicians?
Yeah. I mean, they don't always express it or even allow it to be showed, but it usually is. But you see, the point is groups often... What causes creativity in a group is often that tension. And you know, by making the group happy, they were much less creative. The tension really created the music. I mean, Jeff Beck's greatest solo with the Yardbirds, I think it's a song called The Naz Is Blue. We were making the first studio album, and they didn't get on with Jeff. Jeff didn't like them, they didn't like him, because Jeff was a real musician, and they were not really the same class musically. And with their instruments, they were not the same class. And he didn't get on at all with them, and... they didn't give him a solo. They made a whole album, and Jeff didn't even have a solo. And then eventually they did a blues track, and they said to Jeff, here's your solo. Now you can shine. Now here's your chance to be somebody. And he was so pissed off. He went to the thing, and they were all watching to see him play his studio, and he played one note, and looked through the glass, and just held on that note. And that is the finest 24 bars
genius.
Of one note you ever heard. So that tension caused this amazing track to be made.
Did you have an opportunity to hang on to be part of Led Zeppelin? Because the Yardbirds kind of eventually turned into Led Zeppelin.
No, I mean, they became Led Zeppelin when I got rid of them. They were too much for me. I, you know, the tension was huge. I was I really didn't know what I was doing, even though I was learning. You know, I didn't understand the music still at that stage, and they were, and Jimmy was a very difficult person to deal with.
Why? As a surprise.
Because he just because he was a pig. I mean, he was very unpleasant. He's become a lovely, charming grey-haired. I mean, he's delightful now, but he was really horrible. And Jeff and him argued the whole time, and everybody else argued, and I had a disaster with Jeff because I got them a part in Blow Up by Antonioni, and he'd wanted The Who, and I told Kit. Kit Lambert, who was The Who's manager, told me one night, and he was my best friend. He said, "I'm going. Antonioni's in town. He wants The Who to play in Blow Up, his new movie about London." And I was jealous. I wanted the Yardbirds in it. So I said to Kit, "Look, you mustn't give way to it. You must ask for a lot of money because The Who are really worth it. You ask for £10,000, and tell him you want editing control." Now, films was my background. I knew films backwards. And my dad was a film director. I'd seen all Antonioni's films. One thing he'd never get give up was any editing control. And so half an hour with him, and Kit was kicked out, and The Who were not going to be in the movie. And I called Antonioni and said, "I've got a better group than The Who. They'll be perfect." So I went round to the Savoy Hotel and saw him. We got on rather well. And I said, "I don't know about editing, and we'll do it for free. I just think, you know, I want you to have the best group because I love your films." And, you know, so he fell for it. But then we got to the studios, the Elstree Studios, and he wanted Jeff to smash his guitar. The Jeff smashing guitar was like Keith Moon smashing hotel rooms. Like, this is treasured thing, this beautiful guitar. And so it was a compromise for each one. He wouldn't actually smash his guitar, but we'd give him a second one, which wasn't his real treasured guitar, and he would shove it through the front of the amp. And that was quite dramatic and good. And Antonioni was happy, and the film looked good, and there were about 8 takes. And Jeff quite liked it, so that was all right. Then we went off to America. After we'd done our Looking Stones tour, we went to America for a big tour. Jeff had got the habit. The very first night, he took the guitar and he shoved it through the amp. And it's a Marshall amp. There are 18 Marshall amps in America. We had 4 of them, and there was 14 more. And the tour lasted 14 more nights. We ran out of Marshall amps, and that was it. And Jeff left the group.
I wanted to ask, certainly in the context of Mark Bolan, who you managed after that, but what do you think the characteristics are that a star requires? What are the key things that you need to achieve that level of success? What are we looking for?
Well, the one overriding essential thing you look for in someone who comes to you and says, "I want to be a star, I think I am a star," is a total obsessive. It's a huge drive and obsession with becoming a star. So to the degree they can't even see life without being a star. If they fail, they're going to kill themselves. It's that drive, that vast motivation, which makes it happen. It's not me. I'm not voted. All I do is I've never had any motivation, really. I'm somebody who just likes to breeze around, see what's going on, sit and have a coffee and see people pass by. And so what I'm good at only works when it's coupled with somebody who's got this huge drive and wants to get somewhere. And so from the beginning, I mean, I found rock stars and pop stars rather easy. And they'd come to me and say, you know, "I want to be a pop singer." And I said, "Well, have you had some singing lessons?" "Oh, fucking hell, man, you're a genius. You should..." And so it went. You
have 20% immediately.
You know.
Yeah.
But it is that dual thing. So I need that. That's the first thing I look for when someone comes to me. Of course, you want them to look like a star. I would put singing and songwriting way down the list because they've got to look like a star. They've got to carry themselves like a star. And they've got to absolutely overridingly need to be a star.
So they've got to be a bit mad.
Certainly mad. And the characteristic you get everywhere with every artist who's really an artist ever is extreme imbalance between total self-confidence and absolute disbelief in themselves. So that they're, one minute they stride out on stage in front of 200,000 people, they couldn't, not in full phase, and now they sit in the dressing room, they're frightened just to look out the door. They all have insecurity up to their eyeballs, you know, coupled with this sort of self-belief and self-disbelief. They're all mad, yes.
Right. Tell the story when Bolan rang you up, because it's so interesting, because there's an example of somebody who had incredible self-belief, didn't he? He absolutely...
He also had the other thing too, you know.
Yeah, true.
You know. Well, I was at home. This is when I was managing the Yardbirds, and I got a call one night saying, "I'm a pop singer, and can I come and see you?" I mean, you get calls like this constantly all the time. And I said, "Well, he said, "I've got your address." So I said, I prefer not to give it out, but he's got it already. I said, "Just deliver a tape. That's fine. I'll listen to it and I'll get back to you."
And then he said, well, I haven't actually got a tape, but I've got a guitar. And then literally, actually, 2 minutes later, he knocked on the door. So he was obviously downstairs when he made the phone call. And he looked quite interesting. He looked like a sort of Dickensian urchin dressed in funny...
Tiny, very
small. And tried to make himself look smaller. He liked to be small.
Yeah.
A big guitar. And I thought, well, get rid of this one quickly. All right, sit down, play me the songs. Well, because you know, these people who want to be stars usually aren't very good. I mean, their desire to be a star, they jump at it too quickly. They don't usually practice any music first. 90% of the people who I think look awfully good who could be stars, when you listen to what they've done, they can't sing and they haven't made a proper record. And I just thought he'd be one more like this. And he chose my biggest armchair, a huge armchair, and sat in it, cross-legged it, you know, with his feet up on the chair, and got his guitar out.
Ronnie Corbett.
And started playing songs. And he could only... He only had two chords, and he had a capo on the guitar. And when he wanted to change a chord, because he couldn't do more than two, he'd tap the guitar, so he'd sing a little bit, and that's time for a chord tune. He'd say, go dot, 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 dot. And while he's dot, dot, dotting here, he'd push the capo up, and he could play the next chord. And he was brilliant at it. I mean, he was so brilliant at it, he thought if he could do that, why couldn't he actually learn the chords? But he sang for 45 minutes. I was entranced, absolutely amazed. And at the end of 45 minutes, I stopped. I said, we're going to a recording studio. We went right there that night to a recording studio and recorded the same 45 minutes of songs and a few more, which was eventually released.
Which you eventually put out, didn't you?
Yeah, well, it was released like that, years later, called The Beginning of Doves. Beginning of Doves. And then when he died, I redid it again. I went back in the studio and took all those tracks and did what I thought he might have done with them electronically. And then released it again, which is out. It's called Cat Black, which is now one of the songs on Cherry Red Records.
Do you have any kind of bad conscience when you look back at your relationships with artists in any way?
No.
Not at all.
Artists are so difficult and so annoying that you can only feel saintly that you ever bother to look after them. I mean, they can be lovely people and they have nice moments. And the whole period you're with them, they are like friends because, I mean, you can be with an artist for a year or 2 years and you probably have dinner with them almost, if you're on tour, almost every night. And it's always good and there's always stuff to talk about. Then if you start managing them, you find you never see them again. You don't want to. There's nothing to talk about. Because what makes them... They're totally self-obsessed. So every night you're talking, you're discussing their career and plans, which is fun. It's exciting. You know, it's my job to do it and it's interesting to do it. But once you're not managing them, there's nothing to talk about at all. And they are just that. They're self-obsessed. The biggest or the smallest, that's how they are.
Yeah, did you feel it was worth continuing with Japan for as long as you did?
I mean, well, look, I was stuck with Japan 5 years before they had a hit. And no, I think that's bad business. I think if you're really a sensible or ruthless businessman, you know a point when you give up. I'm not very good at that. I got stuck. And there was a moment after 3 years when I'd invested nearly £250,000. And you know, this is the 70s. It's like putting in £2 million now. It's just, I just didn't know what to do. I mean, they were charming, nice, you know, fantastic musicians.
And also, when you put in that much, you don't want to give up because it could be tomorrow that you get your money back. Yeah.
Anyway, I decided that was it. I had to stop. I had to behave in a business-like manner. And I told them, come tomorrow for a meeting. And I rehearsed it. And that was it. I was going to tell them, very sorry. And they all turned up and they'd all didn't know what a meeting was about. They'd all got dressed up in their nicest clothes and washed and put their makeup on. All came and said, oh, okay, Simon, what is it? And I said, well, we've really got to break this thing, haven't we?
Oh, God.
It's not you, it's me.
And it was another year and a half after that, too.
Really? Go on.
No, it's just very difficult. You know, when you get to like people and they're so enthusiastic, it's very difficult.
But I'm interested in this kind of self-absorption thing because presumably you're also having to... You're reading interviews with them or watching interviews with them on television where they present themselves to the public as kind of fine, altruistic. They're not those kind of people at all. Does that cause you great irritation?
No. The point is you've got to look what your job is. As a manager, you're employed, really. I mean, it may be a percentage and it may look as if you're in charge and perhaps you are, but you're employed by the artist to make them a success commercially. And you mustn't deviate from that. I mean, the artist might come to you and he might be a drug addict or he might be any one of 50 things which are unpleasant or difficult for himself or for other people. But it's not your job to deal with that. It's your job to make him successful. And a lot of making him successful makes them not into nice people. I mean, we take them away from the ordinary life. We put them into hotel suites. We give them limousines. They don't talk to anybody. We have bouncers to stop anyone going to the hotel. We send groupies to their room for sex. And we get them drugs if they want them. That doesn't turn out a bunch of lovely, nice, socially-minded people. And we teach them how to talk nicely to the press and sound as if they're altruistic.
So we are talking about David Sylvian here, are we, or not? I don't know. I'm just guessing.
Well, I mean, anyway, talk about Bono, who spends his life with you two deciding how to dodge tax, and the other half of his life telling everybody how he wants to feed the world.
it's a very reasonable point, which you can't really defend. Yes.
Mark was telling me you've got a theory that Bruce Springsteen's a fraud.
No, I didn't say that. What I said is that any artist becomes a fraud because he acts himself. It's like Mick Jagger, before every Stones tour, has to watch old Stones performances and copy how he dances. He doesn't remember how he dances. He's just spent a year being a normal person walking. He's forgotten. Every time he forgottens every year.
What he thinks when he looks at that. He must think, that's ridiculous.
Well, actually, I heard that the tribute group in Italy, which is the best Rolling Stones tribute group, actually the gut dancer is so good that he now goes over and works with him.
Oh, does he?
But it's not being a fraud, but you watch a Bruce Springsteen concert, and then it comes down silent and he stands there and he fingers his strings and, always. He's done this every bloody night for 15 years. It's got to be an act and not reality. And he sings with such passion, I spit on this lad. And then at the end, he's all happy and everybody cheers. There's something incongruous about this anger when he's singing and then he's perfectly happy afterwards. I wasn't getting him. He's a great performer. But we
have to accept that most pretty much all acts are
acts.
A theatre.
What do we call it?
They're acts.
It is an act. So, I wouldn't say it's a fraud, but his passion is fraudulent, and it is with most artists by that stage.
But the audience don't want to believe that, do they?
I don't think they care. I used to think they care, but now when you look, because you see so much now, a completely different thing, but it's that point. One Direction are now have the same sort of audience that the Bay City Rollers once had, or the Beatles even haven't had. But the difference now is everyone at 10, 11, 12 years old, those kids know how the industry works. They know exactly how it works. They know all the manipulation which is going on to get them to be fans, but they still do it. So they don't care. And I think it's the same with the audience you're talking about. They don't have to believe that it's real. They just want to see it acted well. You don't really. You go and see the old Vic. You see someone playing Hamlet. You don't have to believe that really is Hamlet out there. But you want to see him performing well. And I think the audience will accept that.
So you could probably argue that Bob Dylan is more honest than the Bruce Springsteen.
Oh,
because he goes on stage and simply is pretty much the person he is.
He's great. He does a Christmas album. Yeah, he does a Christmas album. Or he goes on. He goes on radio as a DJ in America and talks about problems he has with his hair falling out. He's fantastic.
No, that's true. He's fairly transparent in that respect.
Yeah. So as somebody who's worked in the music business for a long time and made money and spent money and so forth, how do you look at the success of somebody like Simon Cowell? Do you think, I should have done that?
The music business is about getting it right, and Simon Cowell has got it right. And he has, I've known Simon really well for a long time, and from the first day, he's got this astonishing ability to judge what will be a hit song, not of the highest quality, not those hit songs which come along and sort of make you actually think that pop is art. They are the more trite and commercial songs, although he's also able to judge, very well judge, a good singer who can really perform with passion. But he does has a knack of picking what will be a hit song, and he's got it right, and he's also solved the one problem the music industry had never solved in 200 years, which is payola. Because instead of paying somebody to popularise a song, you play the song on television before it's popular, and then the public pay the payola by phoning and giving you the money to put the record out.
Right.
So he's really done a service for the industry. Despite everyone's getting at him, but he's done a huge service for the industry.
And how do you look at the future of the music industry? You think the game's up?
No. No, look, the conclusion I put in the book is last year, the overall gross for music purchased or money spent on music by throughout the world was $68 billion. The previous year was $64 billion. The previous year was about 62 or 63. And all the record companies will tell you the business is at an end. That's rubbish. Record business may be at an end, and record companies probably are not going to be selling records much longer. And you can understand why they're upset, because whereas publishing, for every time a song's played, a little minute amount, a few pennies come in, and you have to be very good and put it in your piggy bank and let it mount up into millions, record companies have been good at that because they get 10,000% profit. They buy one penny's worth of vinyl and sell it for £10. That's a 10,000% profit. And to do that, well, they need a label and a song title and an artist. And they see all those things as just ingredients. And it's why they treat artists so badly, usually, because they don't really see this as music and an artist. They see it as units of...
But plastic. There was a time when the industry was run by people who... They may have made a lot of money,
yes,
they may have been exploited, but they still loved music.
In the 60s...
They got into it because they liked music. Would that be true now?
Yes. Now, in the 60s and 70s, it was amazing. Those record companies, Armit Ertegun or Nathan or the Chess Brothers, they were ruthless, self-interested hedonists, but they loved music. And definitely they were looking after their own interests. They, all of them were. You know, they're not saints, and they're revered in the music industry, but they weren't particularly good people, but they loved music. And they, because of that, they loved being with the artists, and they treated the artists reasonably well and probably treated them better than most corporations did. But they sold out their companies, and the whole standard went down and down. You started getting heads of companies who were lawyers and accountants but still loved music. And then you started getting heads of companies who didn't even know what music was, you know. And they just looked at the units, and it just got very, very much worse. And that's really where the whole thing went wrong. I mean,
you quote Tom Waits at the end of your book, a lovely quote where he's talking about people's enthusiasm to get a contract. Yeah. Young musicians, you say it's like crossing a river on the back of an alligator.
Yeah, they'll sign anything.
You hear Tom Waits say that.
Listen, even today, you couldn't tell me anyone who's going to the music business, 16, 17, 18 years old, or any other age... who doesn't know about it, heard all the stories, know that record companies sign 10 people for each one's a success. You look at it this way, a records are always signed 10 artists for one person of a success. So you go to your record company and you get a deal. So you run down, I've got a record contract. That's a 90% guarantee of failure.
Because that doesn't really make any difference to people's behaviour, does it? They still want the deal.
You
know?
It's like what you said about they need to believe in the artist. No, they just need to see the good performance. They need to see the record company. They just don't want to believe it. They just, what Tom Waits said, they're so desperate.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tom Waits also said, the large print giveth and the small print taketh away, doesn't
well,
he?
Well,
I think it's probably in the same...
He put it in a song. That was actually said first by some... Vicar in 18.
Oh, well, okay. Yeah. I'm sure everything goes way
that's
back.
That's certainly the case, yeah.
Can I just briefly talk about George Michael, who took a huge gamble in taking on his record company over, who owned his work and so forth. Where do you stand on that? Are you sympathetic to his case?
I was sympathetic, but not in the way he took it on. He took it on because he walked in the office and... He heard the head of the record company refer to him as a limey fag. And I said, you should take it on the basis that you've got a 10-year contract, and you should, if you're tied to a major corporation for 10 years, you've got to work for 10 years, you demand that you're treated with respect. There's respect. If Tommy Mottola, who said it, had said that to one of his employees, he'd have had the union take the whole building out on strike. It's the same thing record companies do not look after their artists. And if you went to America, every single major record company will pay health insurance for every single employee. There's not one artist ever got health insurance. And so when George took the case, and that's what stimulated, that's what pushed him into doing it, I said, take it on that basis. But you know what lawyers are like? Oh, there's no precedent for winning a case that way. We've got to play safe. Let's go to the contract and see if we can find something in the contract which is wrong. And they didn't win the case. So... he would have done better to take it honestly on what upset him.
On the subject of George Michael, so can I just butt in here? It must have been so fascinating when you worked with him all that time to see what happened to him after you'd stopped managing.
He has stayed essentially in the personality of an artist. I mean, neurotic, difficult, very up and very down, all combined into one character.
But when you met him, and he must be around 18, could you possibly imagine the same person to be driving... Range Rovers through the windows of Snappy Snaps in Amsterdam.
I think the average 18-year-old, any 18-year-old, is capable of driving a Range Rover.
Sure, but He was a little older.
In a way, you know, despite his look, he stayed very, very adolescent. He behaves pretty much like an 18-year-old guy still, doesn't he? I mean,
is that because a lot of pop stars are frozen in a permanent
adolescence? Well, they usually are. When they get their success, they're pretty well, you know, that's when they get locked in the hotel suite and they're taken out. Just like, we do it. I mean, I apologise. Don't apologise for it, but, you know, it's we take them out of normal society and they're cocooned and they stop developing. It's very tough for them to come back into it again later. One or two do, but not many.
Does everybody know the story of how Wham came about? Because I actually didn't know this, that George was never going to be in the group. It's a complete revelation. Well, it's amazing. Well,
when George was 11, he was sent to a new school in Bushy, and George was a podgy little kid with glasses and curly hair, a Greek father who ran a restaurant. And he was put sitting next to Andrew, and Andrew was the young sort of lad around the classroom, you know. And good-looking and very, very popular. And George just instantly looked up and said, I want to be like that. And bit by bit, over the next two or three years, George, he lost weight and he got his mum to buy him some hair straightener and put contact lenses in, and he ended up looking pretty good. And they were very friendly. They had a third friend there, David Austin, who's still around, who actually is George's personal manager now, who wrote songs. And George and David wrote songs, and Andrew joined in the writing of the songs. They wrote songs from a group which was going to be David and Andrew and maybe somebody else. They were going to be, you know, real sort of nice, young, heterosexual guys around town having a lot of fun. And
so George was never going to be. He was going to be the Sven Gali
George wanted to write songs. He was obsessed with pop and loved writing songs. He never occurred to be in the group, and he couldn't even sing. And the group got underway and it didn't quite work, and the third person left, and then David didn't want to do it just with Andrew. And then finally George had all these songs and he said, well, I'll do it with Andrew, because by then George looked okay, you know, just a matter of having the confidence. But George didn't have confidence to get up on stage. He needed Andrew to be next to him to have the confidence to get up there. And you don't remember it now, but the whole first year we managed, I managed Wham. Andrew was the one who got screamed at. George didn't get screamed at. They went on stage and everyone said, Andrew. Not George at all. And he learned. I mean, he's a very quick learner. He learned what to do on stage to get the screams, and he dyed his hair blonde, very long and blonde, and put earrings in, and he suddenly looked much more characterful.
Does the screaming suddenly increase?
Yeah, he got his confidence. But, of course, and he was absolutely right not to come out. He didn't even discuss it with me, but if he had, I'd have said, don't come out. Because, you know, normally in pop music, it has to be real. You can't fake. It's not like movies. You can't pretend to be somebody else. When you come out of your house in the morning, there's paparazzi. If you're a fake character, the pop world has been littered with people whose managers have said, do this and do this, and it's not their real image, the real character. They go mad.
Give me some examples of that.
Well, going back to Larry Parnes. Larry Parnes had two artists who ended up in psychiatric treatment just for that, because he imposed these images on them, which they just weren't, you know, being tough or whatever.
Were they ones that we would have heard of? Did they have hits? Or
I can't remember which two they were, but there was certainly two cases where his artist did, and it was straight from that, you know, just trying to make somebody what they're not is very difficult to live with. Not like being an actor on stage where you can go home and be yourself.
Yeah, absolutely.
So George found this very, very difficult, being in Wham, but initially he was absolutely right to stick with it, because that's what the act was. That's what the imagery, everything was dedicated to being these two lads around town. And, you know, the thing about George coming out later, I mean, everyone around George knew what he was. I mean, he wasn't even very private. I mean, he'd go out in the evenings with his boyfriend and you know, Andrew and all the people around him knew. But he was probably right just not to do it. And then in the end he thought, well, rather than say it and then to try to change the whole image of Wham, we'll just bring Wham to an end and I'll become myself. But then he was faced with another problem, because he still couldn't go back to being the George he really was. He just by himself now had to become the George which used to be in Wham. So George Michael also at that stage wasn't quite a real character, which is why he went on fighting with this problem inside himself.
I'm going to ask you one final question, actually, before we wrap up, because Simon's got to sign some books and so forth. Who's the most impressive artist that you've met in pop music?
Well, you're always more impressed by the ones you don't manage, because you don't see all the downsides. Ever? Well, I've got to say George is very impressive. He's the only artist I've known in my entire time in the music business who can produce himself. Others have tried. Paul McCartney tried to produce himself. It's the most difficult. He's got more self-knowledge about his ability and his art than anyone else I've seen. He knows exactly what songs he can do well and what he can't. He produces himself. He's been very clever never to write a song for anybody else, because if he did and it wasn't a hit, then the burden might fall on his song. And people say his songwriter's going off, so he sticks to keeping his own songs for himself. So, he's very impressive. And, one or two others. And
anyone you've ever seen that you wished you'd managed? You thought that as
well,
an opportunity?
The problem is, when you manage people, you always find so many aspects of their character you'd rather not have around you that you presume that anyone you wished you'd manage... I mean, it's nice wishing you could manage them. You wouldn't like to spoil it without actually doing it, you know. I mean, when we were making the video of Careless Whisper in Miami, Wham were at their biggest at that moment. Oh, they were in the UK. And so we allowed six journalists to come. We gave them press passes and said, you can come and go and be around and go everywhere the group go. And on the third night we were in Miami, one of these journalists came over and said, I hope you don't mind, I want to give you a tape. Gave me cassette tape, and I was really angry because I said, look, this is not what you're meant to be doing, you're here as a journalist, so don't do this, and I slung the tape away. Unfortunately, it was Neil Tennant, and what he was giving me was the Pet Shop Boys' first album. And I've got to say, the Pet Shop Boys are absolutely one of all-time favourites of mine in the last 30 years, and I loved that album. And But I'm very good friends with Neil, but would I be if I'd managed him? I don't know.
No, that's true. Absolutely true.
You probably would. Well, yeah. Look, that's all we've got time for. The book's called Tarara Bumdi, eh?
And it's not about most of what we talked about. It is the history of the music
business. It's the history of music business. It covers all kinds of things we talked about, things we didn't talk about. Would you please thank Simon A.B. Bell? And I think Simon's going to be hanging around. There's a little table out there through the door where he'll be signing copies of his book if anybody hasn't got it. It's a thumping good read. Thanks very much indeed to everybody for coming along this evening. And this will be out as a podcast as soon as we can get it organised. Thanks very much for being here. Cheers.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.